This is the M2M Podcast, a production of Iowa Public Television and Market to Market. And now, here's the 2019 Iowa State Fair VIP Cow Chip Toss fifth place winner, Peter Tubbs, and winner, Paul Yeager.
So, Peter, when you hear an intro like that, does that make you proud or inspired to work harder?
It's going to be the latter, because definitely my results in that contest are only, they're just a metaphor for my work here in the unit.
Fifth out of five?
I'm fifth out of five. Yeah. Story of my life. Yeah.
Actually, it's better than being seventh out of six.
True, true. But I mean, my first full-time job in broadcasting, I was the fifth choice for the opening.
Right.
So yeah.
But as they say, you got the job.
I got the job.
Nobody else answered. Well, I'm nobody else.
Yeah.
Yeah. NBE, that's your nickname, right? Nobody else?
Nobody else. Yeah.
Okay, so let's explain this thing. So at the Iowa State Fair, we've talked about in previous MTOM podcasts with other producers about covering the Iowa State Fair. So this year, you were assigned to cover what?
The cow chip throwing and the rubber chicken throwing, which happen a couple hours apart at the same location, so it's a nice little double feature to get onto the air. And I had only seen video of them. I'd never witnessed either contest in person before.
Really? In your time, hadn't
In my time, just I don't recall ever seeing that in person. So it's kind of going into a cold. And I also didn't realize that rubber chicken throwing is a ladies-only event.
Yes. Do you know what it replaced?
Was it the husband calling?
No, that still happens.
Oh, that still happens.
It replaced the rolling pin throwing.
Oh.
Because the women got to be too strong.
Yeah.
And they threw it down the hill onto the cars that were parked at the bottom of the hill. It would be an absolute danger. Those Iowa women and their throwing were tough. We have good softball in this state.
Yeah, I saw how far they threw a weighted rubber chicken. I can only imagine the leverage you could get on a rolling pin.
The rubber chicken looks like the rubber chicken you'd see in the gag, but it basically has a brick of sand in the middle.
Yeah.
And it doesn't really move. You're not supposed to throw it by the leg or the arm, but the body of the bird.
Right. Chuck it like a football.
So, yeah, do you see anybody overhand? Underhand, which was more successful?
There seemed to be no rhyme or reason as to which was more successful. You saw both. You saw success from both. You saw failure with both. So I think it's just up to the individual athlete which is best.
And that was kind of the same for the cow chip toss.
Yeah. I think generally the overhand sidearm sort of thing looked like you had the best results. But when you do that, you have the higher chance of clipping a tree branch. So, yeah.
As you and I stood under the trees at Pioneer Hall Hill, I guess I don't know how to 100% call it, I was describing to you the challenges of throwing, and you were in agreement. I really kind of felt like we were golfer and caddy discussing,
definitely.
Or two golfers looking at the fairway going, okay, so that tree is there, so I've got to hit it. That's at 285. That's usually what your irons are about, 285, aren't they?
Sure.
If you add them all together.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, right.
I use the 2-iron, the 8-iron, and the 5-iron. Okay, so the cow chip contest, it's really buffalo chips. And I basically guilted you into entering. I said, should enter it.
That's fine.
And then the organizer came and said, you should enter it.
Yeah.
And you did.
I did.
And I'm glad you did.
Yeah.
It was fun.
It was funny, yes.
You could say. And you got a pink ribbon out of it.
I'm now a prize-winning entrant at the state fair.
Had you won at the state fair
before? I had never won anything for anything, no.
Not even 4-H?
No, I didn't do anything good enough to get out of my county. I'm flattered you think I'm capable of doing state fair quality work. I've clearly fooled you. So
That was my third. I had two other blue ribbons as a 4-H'er, but that was eons ago. And it was funny because Cameron McCoy, a producer here who does a lot with the Iowa State Fair coverage, he had been asking for fair ribbons earlier in the summer for a shoot he was doing getting ready for the fair. And there weren't any to be given. I think I had a sixth place finish last year, because I think that's green, or maybe seventh.
Mm-hmm.
But in our renovation move, I didn't keep it.
Sure.
and it was gone. So I didn't even have it again. But now next year, I texted him that day. I says, Cameron, I've got your blue ribbon for your feature next year to use. And he goes, nice. Who'd you steal that from? So, yeah, tied in the cow chip toss contest. And I knew that Luke, as I'm supposed to call him on air. I know I'm supposed to – I knew Luke was a good heaver. Okay. And he was going to be the guy to beat that I had known. Because the one guy who I thought was going to be throw – I remember he throws average, not above.
Yeah.
And then there was some other shenanigans going on up there. But, you know, it's still a good time.
It's the media round. They kind of expect shenanigans.
Because by the time I had walked down, gotten my ribbon, walked down and was leaving to go to the next event, I heard over the speaker, Regina says, 110 feet. I'm like, geez, that makes my 80 look very paltry. And I knew I would never have stacked up well against the senior adult.
Oh, yeah. The open class was way tougher than the media class.
Yep. No doubt about that. We're just going to move on and just admit that that was there. Yes. All right. So you covered those two. What other fair features did you have?
I also did – it was 4-H Market Lamb. That was on Monday. So, yeah. Saw a lot of kids handling their sheep.
And we're joined today in the podcast room. We still have some remnants of the fair around, including a picture of a young Mark Pearson, host of Market to Market from 1991 to 2012. That was in the Iowa Public Television booth. And if you follow us on Instagram, that showed up a couple of days in the stories feed of, say, come say hi to Mark. And so now I've put Mark's picture up with one depressed, lonely nail, and I'm sure that will fall before the day is through. But we continue to add to the collection here, and a heads up to you, probably the next time you sit in here, Peter, there will be a shelf in the corner. Phil Blobaum is nearing completion of the shelf that will go in, and it will start to collect items from producers on the road. And I had texted you as such to say, hey, don't forget, because John Torpy and I had discussed that, you know, we bring back knickknacks. You know, like, what am I going to do with it? I think putting it on the shelf and making it a conversation topic. So what did you bring back from your most recent reporting trip?
It has nothing to do with any of the reasons I was there.
I know, which makes it great.
Yes. My last night on the road about 10 miles from my hotel was a Independent League Class A baseball team. So I went and watched a baseball game and got the souvenir baseball that has the team logo on it, the New Britain Bees. So,
and that's New Britain, Connecticut.
New Britain, Connecticut.
And so they used to have, and do they still have, the other New Britain team that plays in Hartford there? That it was the New Britain Twins affiliate for maybe 10 years ago. I don't know if that still exists or not.
There's a team that plays in downtown Hartford called the Yard Goats.
Oh, yes.
You would have to look up the history of them and where did they play in New Britain at one point.
Because it's hard-hitting in New Britain,
nice.
I believe is what was said back in the day.
It's also the home of Stanley Tools, and so their alternate jerseys say Hardware City on them, which is nice. Yeah.
Okay, so you're at a baseball game, and trust me, we will get to your story.
Mm-hmm.
We will. I feel like this is the Mark Marone podcast here, is where I'm going to spend 15 minutes just rambling and never get to the – I just want the actual discussion about the topic. This is the league. Is this the league that has the umpires that are robots?
They did for a time.
Okay.
I think it was like a limited time experiment because they were using the regular human ones the night I was there. And any time there was a ball – you know, a questionable call, you'd hear some guy from the 14th row say, "Bring back the robots!" You know, so that was a recurring gag through the game, so.
That just might be the name of this episode, Bring Back the Robots. Which is true for both of us. I think Dave's looking at a couple of robot models while we're in here to replace us.
Yeah, as soon as AI can do our jobs, we're the first ones gone.
Yep. Okay, so the baseball game, and we did not cover in your last visit when you were in West Virginia on the Salt Story, which I want to say hello to Scott. Thanks for listening to that story and subscribing and giving us a 5-star rating. And we appreciate any of those fans that do that. If you'd like to do that right now, hit pause and hit 5 stars and a review that says Peter is the best. We would love it. We would love it. So you were in West Virginia and you went to a single A game there. Is that right?
Yes. Saw the West Virginia Power, which play in Charleston at a nice little stadium. Yeah.
Single A?
Single A. Yes. Okay.
And then the league that you were seeing is an independent league, not affiliated with the majors, but there's a lot of major league players still on that roster. Formers.
That was something that I was amazed at, because on the lineup sheet that they handed out, almost everybody on the team had been at least in AAA. Probably two-thirds had major league experience. Now, if you start, like, looking them up, it's like, oh, yeah, he was on a team for 22 games, and he had six appearances, and he threw, you know, eight innings if he was a pitcher.
It's 28 home runs.
Right, probably all in September. But, yeah, they had at least worn a major league uniform, and here they were still bouncing around trying to – like, one guy had – he hadn't been in the majors in 10 years, I looked up. And here he was coming in the eighth inning – trying to put out a fire. And
people ask me at the Iowa Cubs AAA level, what do they make? What do you think they make at that level?
Ooh, somewhere between peanuts and nothing.
Gosh, and I think peanuts would be very generous.
Yeah. But
still trying to play because it beats the heck out of working at Sears.
Right,
I've worked at Sears, Crash.
Right, right, right.
Mm-hmm. Anytime I can get a Bull Durham reference, I win a free steak.
Ding!
So thank you. Okay, so you're in Connecticut. And this is not a place people normally think has anything to do with rural America who live in an I state. So why Connecticut?
Well, I think years ago we had a meeting and we were talking about, so what states have we been to lately? And somebody mentioned Connecticut, you know, some of those eastern states. And so I'd sort of filed that away. And this story actually was two stories which are sort of related. And they were both about people who want to get into farming and how do they find the land. One was the primary reason I went. The University of Connecticut is the University of Connecticut is the ag school in the state of Connecticut.
Okay.
And they have – so ag extension comes out of UConn, out of Storrs. And UConn – one professor there teaches urban farming classes. And a couple of locations, one of which is in Bridgeport, which Bridgeport, Connecticut is an old industrial town that, you know, in the 70s and 80s saw a lot of the industry move out and they're still sort of figuring out, okay, what's the next thing? So they have a higher than average poverty rate, a higher than average unemployment rate, and a fair number of empty lots around town. And they have something – it's north of 200 farming plots on abandoned lots, in many cases like on school property. So there'll be like a working little test farm for the kids in that school to work in. And others, civilians can also have a plot on the school property if I understand it correctly.
An existing school or an old school?
No, an existing school, like working school. So like the third grade class will go out once a week and learn about growing things. And that's ancillary to what I went to. But I went to a class that was it's a year-long class where you learn – it's more than just, well, we'll put some tomatoes in the ground and see what happens. No, you're learning soil tilth. You're learning entomology. You're learning – it's rigorous. And when you come out of it, you will be a certified vendor with the state of Connecticut. So you can take your table to a farmer's market and sell whatever you grow. So it's more than just a hobbyist kind of thing. It's like, no, I want to make a living at this, or at least I want it to be a side thing. And talk to people who were both looking at it as a side thing and others who are looking at it as, well, I'm kind of doing some of this now and I want to scale it up. And so I'm learning all the things that I need to know. And it gets into a lot of territory of people wanting to be an entrepreneur, people wanting to be a farmer, people wanting to support their family both with providing them food and then also cash income. And it also gets into the how hard it is to, if you have an interest in agriculture, how do you get started? Because something and access to ground is the first hurdle, whether you're looking for
– whether you're in the city or in an area that farms.
Whether you're looking for a couple thousand square feet in an empty lot to call your farm. Or as in the other story, whether you're looking for 1 acre, 2 acre, 10 acres, 50 acres to start doing whatever it is you want to do. That was the other story. There's a nonprofit group called Connecticut Farm Link, where they will help match prospective farmers with renters who have ground to rent. And a lot of it is figuring out, okay, what kind of things would your ground support agriculturally? Is it grazing? Is it row crop? Is it dairy? Is it, excuse me, is it truck farming? Is it a pick your own strawberry plot? You know, whatever it might be. And, you know, as someone who grew up on the big conventional Midwestern farm, I'm fascinated by operations that can make a living on a much, much, much smaller footprint. We met one of the people we met was he worked full time, but he wanted to farm. He was a native of Jamaica, so he had crops that are familiar to a Caribbean audience that aren't commonly sold at your local Safeway, that he needed a couple acres to grow on, and then he could sell to some grocery stores and sell to some restaurants and sell to some private parties. And he's in his second year of growing, and he thinks that he's like, as he ramps up, like a couple years away from doing it full time and only selling like three crops.
How did he come about determining what crop to plant, knowing – is that where he's from?
He grew up there and emigrated here.
And so he's looking around going, I wish I had this here. I'm going to grow it. But I don't really think of Jamaica and Connecticut having the same type of land, climate to allow something like that to grow.
These crops will grow. One of them is called Callaloo, which I had never heard of until he showed it to me. And in a hoop barn, it can grow and it grows well. And so he's growing enough of it that he can make a go of it. But he found the hoop barns through Connecticut Farm Link, that the resident had been growing some produce and was decided to retire from that stage of it. They still maintain a hay operation on their ground. But they had two hoop sheds, maybe an acre or two next to it, that was available to rent.
So the hoop barn, to me, is that what a lot of these projects end up having, are these hoop barns? Or is it the community garden, here's my things to get me through a certain time of year?
It seems like it's both. Like,
because you've talked about container farming before in cities and metro areas.
Yes.
But is it is there any similarity between that and this?
There isn't. The hoop barn lets you, it extends the season in both directions. Mm-hmm. You can start a month 6 weeks earlier. You can run a month 6 weeks later, depending on what you're growing. And so it lets you extend that season. The growing in the container, that's a whole nother fish, because you could, in theory, grow 12 months out of the year, regardless of where you are. You could be in the desert of Arizona.
Right.
You could be in the wilds of Alaska and grow year-round as long as you have an electrical and a water source.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a fascinating
story. So you're still dependent here in Hartford on having – or Hartford area.
Yeah.
You still need the sun,
mm-hmm.
and you're still going to need some water,
mm-hmm.
and some dirt.
Right.
What, are they finding problems with any of this dirt? I mean, you say that they try to determine, because it's like, oh, that was a toxic waste dump at one point.
No. These are all, at least in the farms that are working farms that are looking for renters, those are all working operations. Now, someone may have been, say it was mostly hay and forage. They may like the image of, well, yeah, let's have some hoop sheds and pick your own strawberry farm. But if it's on a 20-degree slope, that's just not going to work. You're going to have to kind of keep that in grazing. So there are some limitations to what the prospective renter can get into. But generally, for that story, it's working ag ground that just needs a new operator and matching those people up.
Hmm. And how many are in the program? Ballpark?
It's a few dozen each year, if I remember going through the website. But it's been growing as they've been in existence and getting the word out and people understanding, oh, yeah, well, you can use this as you retire. And like the rest of rural America, those who own farmland in Connecticut are aging. So each year there's going to be a few more people who are either going to have to – are making that decision. Mm-hmm. Well, do we put down a crop of houses or do we rent this out as farm ground for someone else? Even if we retain ownership, can we find someone else to work the land?
Challenge everywhere.
Yes.
That they're all facing.
Yeah.
Okay. So urban farming and then the renters with the ground. Okay. Right. Those are the two. Connecticut as an ag school. What is their focus? Are they – because a lot of those ag schools are focused on what their region is, right? They're not studying what Montana has. They're doing what Connecticut has.
And it's going to be a lot more, you know, the working dairy since there's such a big audience for dairy right there.
Right.
You can still be, you know, a working dairy in that region as long as you can find enough forage. Like we, you know, we took some – stopped and took pictures of couple cornfields, couple soybean fields. And I mentioned that to one of the locals. He said, oh, yeah, that's going straight to a critter. You know, there's no elevator.
Oh, yeah.
There's no elevator they're going to try to sell that to sell it to, you know, for export market. That's strictly for local consumption, probably for a dairy farm. And like the farmer I met who had the hay operation, that was all going to horses in the neighborhood. So.
Well, some people like horses, even in the city.
That's right.
And they want to not have to go to Kentucky. They'd love to have them within 50 miles, 40 miles of where they live.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, or they have the small, you know, they have the small acreage and they have four horses and they got to find local food for it all the time. Mm-hmm. So.
So Connecticut is just north of New York and south of Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm.
Massachusetts has been known for, you know, plenty of agriculture. Upstate New York has a lot of things, but my limited experience in Connecticut a couple of times is it's a lot of trees and the beachfront and very expensive houses. So how much land is percentage in this state that is even available for agriculture? It's not half.
Oh, no, no. It's probably in the teens, just putting my finger in the air.
Yeah.
I did see a map of the kind of had like percentage of townships that are in, you know, working agriculture. And there are some that you get into 40, 50% of the ground is workable for agriculture. A lot of it's limited to, you know, there's just topography because there's so much less soil for most of it. And the joke is that you're just farming rocks in a lot of cases. Yes, and lots of trees and lots of city and, you know, lots of, you know, we would drive about, you know, we'd drive for miles and miles and miles and it'd be house, acreage. Oh, wait, that looks like a farm. Pull over, you know.
Yeah.
And so we'd shoot whatever it happened to look like and then drive 3 or 4 miles down, you know, random roads looking for anything that looked like, you know, what I'm used to thinking of agriculture.
Well, and I'm guessing those farmsteads, you talk about whether they would be a crop of houses or, you know, some farm fields. I would imagine the pressures that some of those farms face for selling out to turn that acreage into lots is always high. And you're like, if I'm working this hard and losing this money, why am I doing that again?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Especially as you get into the southwestern part of, you know, the closer and closer you get to that New York corridor, the pressure goes up and the amount of farmland goes down. But there are still big stretches of the state that because of distance to Boston or Hartford or New York. And there may not be – like if it's two-lane roads, it's a lot less attractive for a commuter than if you're a few minutes from, you know, an expressway, an interstate. So like the northwest and northeast corners are still much more agriculturally driven than, say, the southwest corner just from economics.
Right.
So it varies, but there is a surprising amount of working farmland, even in a place like Connecticut. So.
Right. So Connecticut, let's see. We've been to Rhode Island, Massachusetts. We haven't been to Maine in a while.
I don't think anyone's been to Maine for a while.
We've talked about it.
I remember years ago I was on a trip to Western Massachusetts and Vermont.
Josh has been to Vermont.
Okay. I'm not sure anyone's been to New Hampshire lately or say
just
like,
political candidates. We could just ask them.
There you go.
Tell us about New Hampshire.
Yes. Why are you there?
Agriculture policy.
Can you take a few pictures for us? Yeah. And then like Rhode Island. I don't know if anyone's been there lately, but.
Well, John and a wind story.
Oh, that's right. That's right. You're
offshore
right.
Wind.
You're right. You're
yeah,
right.
Yeah. Which is a back episode of the MTOM podcast. And you can go back and listen to all of our episodes if you download the app. They're available there. And again, if you have one of those 5-star ratings that you're just looking to hand out like candy, we'll take it. And the other good way to share our content. You know, say, hey, I listened to this episode. I think you would be interested. Then you click subscribe. And before you know it, we're all in on, I won't call it a joke. You're all in on the content. That'll be nice. We're all in on it.
That's a better way to put it.
Yeah. I suppose if I keep calling it a joke, Dave's not going to like that. So what else? Anything else before I keep dropping these promotions in the middle of our content discussion?
No, that's great. But between going to West Virginia and then having the Iowa State Fair and now this trip to Connecticut, I am, shall we say, way behind in my writing and editing. So
what you're saying is I should probably let you go so you can go to that. I'll cover the trade beat for you for a while.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much.
And do what I can. So let's see. We talked about subscribing, liking, sharing, thanking you for the comments. Thanks to Scott for being a new subscriber and Paul for always listening. Always good to have guy number two in our midst and any of our other friends. We appreciate you who have been loyal to us throughout this run. If you do have any comments or concerns, questions, or you just want to drop me a note, send it to paul.yeager, Y-E-A-G-E-R, at iptv.org. And I guess if you want to talk to Peter Tubbs, I don't know, do you want me to solicit an email for you?
Sure. I'm peter.tubbs at iptv.org.
If you have a small baseball stadium you want him to come and look at and make me insanely jealous or just somewhere to visit, send him a note. Or the show, Market to Market at iptv.org. So for all of us here at Iowa Public Television, which is where the M2M podcast is produced from each and every week, for Peter Tubbs, I'm Paul Yeager. Thanks for listening.